Hey, leaders, listeners, and life's most curious people, this is Meaningful Mischief. Three entrepreneurs in pursuit of bringing our best, giving the most, and having fun along the way. No overnight successes, scaling hacks, or planning models here. Just a conversation about what we're learning and loving about meaning, impact, health, wealth, and everything in between. This is Meaningful Mischief. Let's jump in. Hello, everybody. Welcome back.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back.
It's me and James again today with Stell traveling around the world and doing other things. So we thought today we would talk about the psychology of money. And what's funny about that is that I read a study recently, a couple years ago, that people would rather talk about like death than their own money. I don't know, James, if you've experienced that. We can get into it a little bit later. But that people avoid the topic of finances and money and all of that. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to share their own information around it, etc. So funny enough, here we are just going to spend a whole episode talking about the psychology of money. So, all
yeah,
right.
I mean, fear definitely drives, is more powerful than greed.
Right.
I mean, look at the publications and newspapers and journalism. You know, fear is what people get attracted more to fear than they do to greed. And you're right, it's kind of a taboo topic that people don't want to talk about investments and what they have. Some people are embarrassed about it and don't want to open the conversation. They want to tell everybody that everything's okay, or maybe behind closed doors it's not. So there's a lot of psychology around money. And what we are doing internally and what we maybe should be doing.
Right. And so some of you know this already because we've introduced ourselves more, but you know, I'm in the world of strategy, communications, messaging, branding, that kind of thing. And James and a bunch of other dimensions of things that aren't really functionally about what I do. And James is in the world of wealth management. So that is, and if you want to speak a little bit more about that, James, but we've known each other and hung out now and done this podcast for more than, well, almost a year, maybe a little bit. And you and I have never really talked about money either, even though that is your wheelhouse, which is kind of funny, right? This is our first time talking about it.
True. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, we've had conversations and in general terms, but no, I specialize in helping individuals and families. Generally in the Middle East, but over the last 15 years of doing it here, I've had the privilege of working with people that are just starting their financial journey all the way to, you know, billionaire families. And there's an interesting, I'd say, development of the psychology of money and the way that it makes the individual think and feel, not necessarily always attributed to it's better the more money you have. And I think we talked about this on a couple of podcasts ago, that I'm doing some research right now, that there's kind of a sweet spot of amount of money that you need to be happy. Above that, I think you start to it can deteriorate the happiness, and below that figure or that bracket, you know, there's some struggles. You don't necessarily have the things that you want in life, but it definitely is not the more money that you have, the happier you are, despite what people think.
Totally. So what's that number? Ish.
It's between, and obviously depends on where you are, age, health, okay, and children. But it's between kind of the $500,000 mark up to the kind of like $20 million mark.
Okay, so it's a pretty big window.
It is, but there are still a lot of people that will have 10, 15 million or 5 million now, starting off in their career, and they've done really well or exited a company, and they're trying to go again and reinvest and make sacrifices. Oh. And they're trying to go to 100 million, 500 million and above. It's not. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have better health, life, enjoyment, happiness.
No, you know, it's interesting. So when I studied positive psychology, this comes up a lot. And one of the studies was just saying that after you achieve food, shelter, clothing, and whatever that means, wherever you live in the world for the cost of living, after you've achieved food, shelter, clothing, that the delta between someone that's there, call it, I don't know, years ago, 15 years ago, was like 70 grand a year. After you go north of that to whatever, millions or billions, there's the delta in happiness was quite small, almost negligible. So that, yes, you need money in order to feel security and take care of your family and have a roof over your head and stuff like that. But beyond that, money and happiness don't correlate. But does money and the absence of fear correlate? If you have more money, do you feel less afraid?
No, I think the people with once you go kind of beyond the 100 million, I think there's a significant amount of fear.
Really?
And if Stell was here, actually, there's another underlying dimension, because what is needed to reach that level of wealth in terms of becoming, 100, 200, a billionaire, there is something inside them which is, of course, unique and is driving them at such a hard level that will be there regardless. So it's a fear of not being enough, and maybe it's something to do with the way in which they were raised, or their parenting, something that would have happened that makes them an exceptional individual at building wealth, and that will always be there, no matter how much money that they have.
Right. The drive to do that will always be there because that's actually at a deeper level. And if there's two things humans need, or I guess the two greatest fears, one is that we're not enough. And the second one, isn't it just that we'll be rejected, that we won't have love? And I mean, it makes sense.
Not
Because in order to survive in the world, human beings need to be connected to others and they need to contribute because we know that we, in order to, perpetuate the human race, we need to make progress. So those are like deeply embedded things. And depending on who you are, how you grew up, what factors influence those two needs, it's manifested itself in a certain way. And what I'm hearing you say is that for some people, the drive to accumulate wealth and be very good at it is the outcome, but the inner needs are there no matter what the material outcomes are.
And a lot of it is just is simplifying it, because finances and investments can be a very inwardly challenging topic. We weren't taught it at school. Okay, we were taught basic maths, but we weren't taught how to be financially free. We weren't taught, how to take care of families, how to pay the bills, how to save, how to invest, what to invest in. Like, none of us were taught that. And I think that everything is relative to your situation and what you want. We all have different needs, but what's interesting is that all the books and everything that everybody talks about is the actual investment itself, and the investment is just the vehicle. When I talk to clients, we say that, you're in position A right now, which is your life right now, and you want to achieve position B. The car will help you get there, but don't get so fixated on the car. What we want to get fixated on is position B. What is it that you want from your life? What type of, lifestyle do you want? What brings you happiness? How do you want to spend your time? Where do you want to be living? Do you want to be, going on holiday with friends and family, and just kind of putting down a to-do list of the things that you want from your life, and then reverse engineer it from that point.
Right. Now,
Imagine that.
can you give me
Yeah, go on.
yeah, I was just gonna say, because I wanted to clarify, or could you give me an example of people what it looks like to get fixated on the car, which is the mechanism? What would that look like for some people?
So they would, and it's very obvious, because a new client would come to me and say, yeah, I want to invest into some real estate. I want to invest into some bonds. I want to put the money into the markets. And I say, okay, out of curiosity, why? Why are you picking them? And they go, oh, because I've read that they are the right type of investment. And so
Or
that,
in video or whatever, like the latest trend, yeah.
and unfortunately, without even understanding, their risk appetite and everything that goes with it, they're starting with, the vehicle rather than the that's like getting into a taxi and saying to the taxi driver, turn left at the lights, and then he drives and he said, well, where do you want me to go? No, turn right, and then turn left and turn right. But you don't give him the location of where you want to end up. You're just
Right.
focusing on, the vehicle at the time. And
Right.
it's like an architect. If you were going to build a building, you wouldn't just start with building it from the ground and then picking the bricks and the door and the insulation. You'd start with the end project in mind, the finished article, then you'd reverse engineer it. And
So interesting. Yeah.
this is what people don't do, unfortunately. And so they
So
get
we
so fixated on the returns of the investment and going, well, the average return is X, so I want to achieve that, or maybe slightly greater, so I can feel I'm ahead of everybody else. And it might not even be the right type of investment for them, depending on their position B.
So interesting, because I find myself relating it to other things that human beings will do, like it's action without strategy, it's tactics without strategy. And if whether that's in your business or maybe even in your own health or whatever, you want that, quick payoff. We tend to see the immediate, tangible thing we can understand and go for that, because that can give you immediate comfort, reward, whatever, versus something I don't necessarily understand. The more complicated it is, the longer I have to wait. Like, it's hard for the human brain to sort of wrap their head around that. And then what's so interesting, so one of the reasons we're talking about this today is because I work with different companies and I help leaders create the vision and story of who they are, their business, the mission, the values, what makes them different. And I just so happen to be working with a handful of wealth management firms in the US and Canada right now. And so as part of my process, I interview clients of my client. And so I have, in the last 8 weeks, probably interviewed two dozen, what we would call high net worth individuals, and talked about their journey. Like, why did when did you choose to work with X firm? Had you been working with someone else before? Like, and then I try to get into, like, so, their values, their priorities, the stories about their life and stuff like that. And so I just found some things just super fascinating, because these people would qualify as having money. So, and let's call it 2 million or more in investable assets, generally. Plus or minus, I don't know specifically for each of the people. Some of them could be way higher and some of them could have been a bit lower. But what was interesting to me, and some of them were like the top of their field, like Ivy League professors, like some of the smartest people in the world. And yet the insecurity about the money piece, because they're like, I'm a psychology professor, or I've built a business in whatever sector that is thriving, and I can't help but grow. But managing my personal finances and that whole picture, there's an intimidation factor. Like, and it was great that many of them were open about this. And then successful people feel like they should know better, and so there's even worse shame maybe in it, because they're like, well, I have all this money, but I don't know what to do with it. I can't tell people that.
So
It's just interesting.
they feel negatively towards it.
Yeah.
And this is the this so there's another layer of this, which comes down to the risk of invest, because there's always risk with investments. Risk and reward are proportionate, in the same way. The more reward you want, you have to offer more risk to try and achieve it. And interestingly, I saw a new a couple that were potential clients. I think they're gonna come on as clients last week, and they had a preconceived idea in their mind of what type of investments they want. They've done investments previously, they've been successful, built up a good amount of wealth, but when they was asking, and they went in like most people do, they start off talking about what type of investments that they've done and what type of investments they want moving forward, and they want me to help them. But one of the wife had some underlying fears around investments that, they're going down and not taking too much risk and everything. And so when I reversed engineered the calculation for them, which they'd never done before, even though they'd been with advisors for many years, it turns out that they actually had, for the income that they needed from their investments, they already have enough money. So what we then did was redesigned it where we can dial down the level of risk, because now we're picking investments that suit their lifestyle and what they need. So it's all designed around them. We're not just picking them for the sake of it, because that's what's topical at the time. We're designing it specific to them. So at the end of the meeting, they go away knowing that actually we can reduce the risk down significantly and give more predictability and better investment quality, great investments, to achieve the lifestyle that they want.
Otherwise, they're on this treadmill, and who they were, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, or whenever they started their investment journey, 10 years ago, I have no idea. But they were, we need to grow our wealth. And so that was the mission. And so coming in with that same mindset, not having done the analysis to say, well, what situation are you in and what situation do you want to be in? Like, that's your, here you are with plan A versus plan B, right? Yeah, that's fascinating. And so the other thing that they might have learned, if they know they have enough, then maybe they would be the type of people that say, okay, good, then we don't have to be so cautious. We could take a portion and try to grow more and know that it wasn't going to eat away, it's depending on their
Yeah,
internal
exactly.
drivers, right?
And this is
Yeah.
where, it is an individual thing, and it can sometimes get challenging when husband and wife have different views over money. So sometimes you have to kind of either compromise or segregate different parts of the investments to suit each other.
Right.
Because it is completely a psychological play. It's and one other thing, just to share with you about the psychology of things, and I find this fascinating, that let's say, for example, a client wanted to invest, or my advice was to invest into a particular stock. Let's just say Amazon. I'm not advising to invest into Amazon, but just let's just say Amazon for the sake of it. The client might say, no, I'm not going to put the money in. It's really expensive now. But if I show them the chart of where it was, let's say 4 or 5 years ago, and it's gone up, and I say, if I'd asked you at that time and I'd showed you the previous 4 years, let's say I'm going back to 2020, and the graph has continued to go up from 2020 to now, and 2017 to 2020 had also gone up. So I said, look, if I'd asked you in 2020, do you think you should invest into it? Given the 3 or 4 years that have happened previously, what would you have been your answer? And they say, well, of course it would have been expensive, but relative to now, if I could get you in at the price of 2020, you'd bite my hand off, because it'd be incredibly cheap. So everybody always just looks at things as, oh, it's expensive, it's now, there's no value in it. But it's the same with buying a house. It's the price of something, the psychology around buying things is if why do you think so many companies do sales? They inflate, often they'll inflate the price of something and discount it back down to what was the original price to satisfy the buyer that, oh, I'm getting in a discount.
Or the loss leader, like you discount the price of milk so that people come to your store, but then you inflate the prices of everything else just to be able to, because the store's not going to lose money, right? Yeah. It's so funny how our minds work that way too, because I could go, like, there really is no rational relationship between what I think is valuable and the absolute cost of that thing. So I have a thing where I don't like going out for dinner for crappy food. Like, I just am like, oh man, and I'm not gonna mention any crappy food restaurants, but there's some restaurants out there that you go to and you're like, ugh, why do we do this? When our kids were in sports and we found ourselves going to traveling around to tournaments and stuff, you'd find yourself at these kind of chain roadhouse type places. And I'd look at the bill and be like, man, that was like, I don't know, 150 bucks for the four of us to eat garbage. And so for me, that felt expensive. But then I have no problem every day spending $5 on a coffee,
Yeah, if
which,
it's good.
over time, I listened to a podcast recently where the host had calculated, it was actually a really good podcast, by the way. Did you ever listen to Acquired? It's
No.
so good. You would love it. It's funny that
Okay.
we're referencing a podcast, but Howard Schultz was on from Starbucks and they talked
Okay.
for 3 hours. And the host had calculated how much money he had spent on Starbucks since he could go back. So let's call it 20, I don't even know, 2017, whatever it was. $22,000 he'd spent at Starbucks. Like every day he goes and he gets a coffee and a sandwich and after over time, right? So in my head, that $5 coffee, I deserve it. But the minute you put me at a crappy restaurant with fries and burgers and wings or whatever, and I'm like, oh, like that's not worth it to me. And those things aren't rational. It's just my own optics around something, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, there's many ways you can play things. I mean, there's even a good study that says a Starbucks a day for 25 years invested into the US S&P 500 gives you $1 million.
Right.
You know.
Imagine where I would be.
No, but also at the same time, you know, if you enjoy your coffee, I'd argue that, you know, you shouldn't sacrifice 25 years of every day enjoying something and being in the moment, and because we talk a lot about, you know, balance and health and well-being. I think that money and investments are there to serve a purpose for us. We're not we the investments are designed to work around what we want from our life and our lifestyle. And this is where understanding and having a healthy relationship with money, you know, where we should enjoy things, we should indulge, we should have that balance. But yes, we need to understand what our goals are, what we're trying to achieve, and be disciplined around that.
You know what I think is so interesting? This whole thing is so interesting to me, and it's almost like the world is telling me, Mary, you have to focus on this because it's just like so much of it is coming in, and I'm learning from different people. But the relationship between people and their financial advisor is one of the most intimate relationships going. I mean, I've talked to people who say, I tell so and so more than I tell my own children.
Yeah.
I had a major like health event, and the first call I made from the hospital was to my advisor. Like in those very positive relationship ones where it's about the whole life. Like I think your philosophy around, money is in service of how you want to live, and you help people look at that whole picture. The role then, therefore, of the financial advisor is so much more than money. In fact, money's almost, it's like the tool, but you're like a therapist. You're like how do you reach inside people and help them see their money issues? And then also, not just one person, but two people in a relationship, right? You mentioned husband and wife. I spoke to people who like have bags of money and literally were arguing about Starbucks. And then they went into their financial advisor, and the financial advisor like gets a calculator out and just like shows them this is the impact of Starbucks on your portfolio. You don't need to argue about it anymore. So it's interesting because you almost are a life coach slash therapist who knows the tools of the financial markets.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's relationship and lifestyle first. We're just pulling, you know, something out of our bag to support them on their journey. But the better that we know the clients and the closer the relationship, the more that we can really understand. Because sometimes when clients will give a response, and when I know them well, I'll know that that response is like they'll say, "Look, I really want to go and invest into this." And I was like, "Okay, we can." But, you know, remember the conversation we had 2 years ago when you got really nervous that this happened and you called me up going, you know, I don't like it and what should we do? Do you really think that's what we should be doing? Because you're telling me one thing, but I actually think meaning something else. And then they're like, no, actually, you're right. I'm glad that you said that. I'm you know, I shouldn't have said that I want to go into the investment. So
Like it's reactionary because we're emotional.
yeah.
And then you get to be the voice of reason because your job, you're almost the steward of their life vision and plan. Like you're the one that's like, hey, remember over here we did this work? So let's
Yeah.
not react in the moment or buy the boat or sell everything. Like the markets today are an unsettling place, and I understand that lots of clients are calling their advisors, and talks of tariffs and impact around the world, and I imagine the phone's ringing more now than, I mean, I don't know. The markets are the
No,
markets, but
it is, and obviously since Instagram and social media, where there's lots of people giving advice, clients will forward articles and say, oh, apparently we should get out of this today, and then try and get in next month because it's going to crash and things. It's like, well, we're not here to try and time the market. We were never going to be traders. The people that make the best returns are the ones which hold on to the investments for the long term, and you can weather the storm. When people start to go in and out of the markets and trying to trade, it becomes incredibly risky because you've got to get it right twice, not just once. And so to continue to do that consistently, I don't know anybody that can.
It feels like to somebody like me, I don't know if I told you this story, but when I was 21, I lived in New Jersey and I worked at one of those types of restaurants. It was Chili's. And I we and it was a, New Jersey is a very gambling culture just because it may be Atlantic City, whatever. It was so fun. And we'd do 50-50 draws in the middle of our shifts, like everybody throw a dollar in a bag and write your name on it. And I had like colleagues who were ringing in food, but on the phone with their bookies and stuff like that. So it was fun and exciting from that perspective. But finished a shift, drive the 2 hours or whatever it was to Atlantic City, go to a blackjack table. And I'm like 20. Like I think I had a fake ID to get into the casino. So like I'm brand new at this. Go to the blackjack table, lose an entire night's worth of tips in like 12 minutes. And so I have like, I don't know if that moment affected me, but I have like a such an aversion to gambling and the playing the markets to me when you describe it, and I don't know the markets, but it feels like gambling. It's like, oh, I'm going to strike exactly in this moment and then strike again exactly in that moment. And there's so many factors in play. It feels akin to playing the lottery or in my case, blackjack, you know?
I mean, it's the challenge is that the people that are giving all of these tips and advice online are the ones that if they keep doing it on a daily basis, at some point they'll get it right. Right. So they might get it wrong 20 times, but then what they'll do is they get it right once, and then they'll go out to everyone and go, remember when I look at this article that I posted 4 years ago that said that Bitcoin would be at this value? Yeah, but what about the other 30 articles that were wrong? And so nobody ever talks about the losses. They always talk about the wins.
Fair.
And so, we're not into trading and gambling. We do investing, which is something different. And again, it's around trying to, or making sure that the investment serves the purpose for the client. And there will be times, because it's like anything, social media and society pulls us in this direction. I have a client of mine, which has been maybe 8 or 9 years, and we've set the strategy and we're on track and on target and everything. But occasionally, he will send me an article, and that will be, oh, do you read this, tell me what you think. And it's almost like we have to go back and just, yes, of course we can go in and we can play with it, but we're playing with it, and it's not a strategy. It's just it's we're flipping a coin, and it could 50-50.
It's kind of like I know in my life plan that alcohol and sugar are not good for me. And so when I'm really good, I just don't worry about those. I don't, I avoid them. But then sometimes the draw of the ice cream cone or that really great bottle of wine pull you back, and then you have to have the conversation with yourself again. So, like most human behavior, the psychology of money is the same, perhaps.
It doesn't, like we were talking on the last podcast about meditating and me doing certain things that I know work, and then we go back to our old habits, and regardless of the results. And interesting, one other very psychological aspect of investing, I always say the same thing to clients, that along this journey there are going to be downs in the markets. And what we want to be doing is taking advantage, because that's when there's a sale on. Like, let's say we're in, was it the 23rd of June? have some political issues going on in the region right now, and markets will probably drop this week or in the next kind of few weeks. It's a good buying opportunity for clients that have stored up a little bit of cash that want a dollar, what's called dollar cost averaging, add money into their portfolio maybe every kind of 4 or 5 months a year, or maybe every year. But you want to take advantage of them down periods because there's a sale on maybe 10 or 20% discount. So I say to clients, store up some cash because, of course, there isn't a perfect straight line. There'll be some ups and downs, but when it's the downs, you put some money in, and when it goes back up, you'll thank me for it because you've just made, extra money. And guess what happens? When markets are down and I call everybody, they always say, no, I'm a bit nervous. Maybe down a little bit more. Let's stop. I don't want to put it in. And then as soon as it jumps back up and it's at an all-time high again, they call and say, oh, I've seen that the markets are doing well now. Maybe I should put that cash in. And it's like,
Counterintuitive.
yeah, you just lost 15% on that bit of cash that you could have put in. And then, but the thing is that they all get the concept, and they look wet. Okay, and in that scenario with this client, I say, look, the next time that it happens, which it will, do you think you should be putting it in when it's down or when it's up high? No. Call me when it's down, and I'll put it in. And of course, you call them, and they will say no. So the psychology. So it's all well and good having the strategy and understand it. The psychology around things sometimes overrides what is kind of logical and makes common sense.
Do you this brings me back to the Simon Sinek book and his TED Talk, Start With Why. And he talks about, and I don't know if he's got it completely right in terms of the brain science, but when he breaks down how people make purchase decisions, he'll say that it's from the part of the brain that doesn't have logic and that doesn't have language. And I'm not sure which part that is, but the prefrontal cortex is the part of us that has language and analytics and rational thinking and all of that. But it's that sort of emotional brain that's making the decisions, and then we find rationale for that decision. And so it's interesting, you have to get to the emotion behind the decision, because no amount of making the case can help you if it's fighting against a pretty strong emotional driver, I would think.
And that's why spending the time, any good wealth advisor will spend a lot of time first understanding the client, the journey, the needs, what they want, what they don't want. What the fears are, and then you start to talk about investments. Going in there on day one talking about investments is, I mean, there's different ways of doing it, but it's I personally like to understand the clients at a deep level first.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Otherwise, you're just a mechanism for them to invest. You're not really advising them. And it's clear that people need that role in their life. They don't, we bring baggage to our marriage. We bring baggage, like we bring all of this stuff that we've grown up with, whether it was in the world of you never have enough or you were never taught anything or whatever. Like, you bring that stuff. And who else helps you sort it out? Like, it's so interesting to me. Like, we see professional coaches out there, personal coaches, professional coaches, sports coaches. We see therapists. There's all kinds of resources to help people deal with anxiety and depression and like all of this stuff. And yet, in the world of wealth management, it's incumbent on the actual wealth advisor to become comfortable with the psychology, the emotion, to cultivate those skills to be able to advise people. I like to my knowledge, based on what we've looked at in the category for our clients, is there's not a lot of tools. It's not like when you go to when you take whatever exams you have to take and pass whatever certifications you pass, the psychology of money, to my knowledge, doesn't come up.
True. It not at all. And it's the most, I think, critical roles. Your individual relationship with money, because ultimately we have to. Our life, unfortunately, does revolve around money because that's what dictates, the outcome of what we can do, where we work, the time spent on certain things, the things that we buy. Places that we go, you know, what country we're living in, the gifts that we can give to people, the people we can take care of. You know, it does make a big difference. And you know, I think if there was no price tag on anything, and this is where I kind of start with clients, if there's no price tag on anything, and you was to design the life that you wanted, you know, where you'd be working or not working, what you'd be doing, who you'd be spending time with, the activities that you'd be doing. What does that look like? You know, no one chooses to turn right at, when they get to an airplane, do they? If it wasn't about the price tag, and it was, let's say, a first come, first serve, I think everyone would arrive at that airport probably 4 or 5 hours before if they could knew that they could fly for it, and there was no price at all. They could try and get first or business class. Everyone would get there earlier.
Yeah,
But
totally.
it's sometimes the not always, but it's sometimes the restriction or limitation of cash that means that we're not able to always have the things that we want. And it's not always good to have everything that you want. But you know, we life on our terms has to be more enjoyable than continuous sacrifice.
Totally. I think about the well, there's the psychology of money, but then the psychology of spending. You know, we live in a world where everybody has everything. You know, my kids, they're teenagers, and they tune in to the different families and the ones with cottages and the ones with fancy cars and the fancy clothes and stuff like that. And I was just saying to one of them on the weekend that just because people have a lot of stuff doesn't mean they have a lot of money. Like, don't look at the stuff and the cars and the whatever as an indication of financial health.
Yeah.
Right. In fact, in many cases, the opposite is true. You know, my sister's in-laws are, well, her father-in-law passed away. I think I told you guys about him. He ended up with Alzheimer's, and it was a quick, like he had like a 6 month stint with it, or maybe it was longer, but after diagnosis, and then he passed away. But then his wife, they were living in many ways like paupers. And then his wife found out, after all told, that they were sitting on, you know, a good chunk of money, like, and that she didn't know about. And maybe some of it had to do with the dementia and all of that, but to live like you have nothing and can't go anywhere and can't enjoy life and stuff like that, only to amass a pile of cash that is there when you go, is the one end of the spectrum. And then for the people who are like, well, we need to have the nicest cars and the best house and the best dinners, and we need to show people we have expensive wine and like whatever, the flip side of that is also not good. And then there's not a lot of attention in the middle of people who are just living the moderate life that kind of get it and don't need to show it all off.
And the relationship with the money is different. If you are, and we see this a lot with families that we work with, that the difference between first, second, and third generations, first generally build the wealth, the second they spend the wealth, and the third they have to go back into rebuilding again because it's already gone. Sometimes it can be 3 generations, sometimes 4 generations, and it can be lost. But it's not always good in there. I mean, you look at a lot of billionaire children that have inherited the money from trust funds. It's very challenging because they've almost had their one purpose in life. If you go back to historian times with men, that our role is to take care and protect. And if that one element is you know, money is already there, and I don't need to go out and hunt, and I just need to sit there and take care. It's kind of that's where maybe there's a shift of the dominant male becoming more, you know, female, or not understanding what it is, what's my role now, because my one role to go out
Provide.
and provide, and now I don't need to. So there is, you know, it's also healthy to want to keep building, you know, and expanding upon what you have, and no matter how much you have, this is why I was saying, you know, I think what the reason why I said like kind of 25, 30 million is that once you get to that figure, there's literally nothing, you don't need any more money
Right.
to, it won't change your lifestyle unless you go and buying, you know, a $100 million plane or a $100 million yacht. Literally, you can do anything that you want. There is nothing
Yeah.
that money can't buy. So beyond that, it's then just a case of looking at, you know, everything else internally. Rather than investments and building. But yeah, it's a, I mean, you know, we've already been an hour or so, but there's a really good book, which is The Psychology of Money. We'll leave a link, but that's by Morgan Housel. And that goes into a lot of, but in depth, a lot of what we're talking about today. But rather than just jumping on the kind of the rat race and doing, you know, investing into things because everybody else is investing it. It's worth kind of just looking at the A and B scenario of where I am, what is it that we want, and starting to think about, you know, the investments need to work for me rather than the other way around.
So, what would you say? Because it sounds like that would apply to anybody at
Yeah.
any stage. Because whether you're behind the eight box, you said, you know, there's a fear and a shame around people don't have enough. They haven't managed it well. They're not their eyes off the ball. They don't really want anybody to point that out to them. It's sort of this hidden secret in the closet. Or people are new in there, like my kids. You know, they're in university and you know spend money like it's nothing. Like they're spending their And, you know, on some level, I feel like, oh shit, we didn't do the right thing because they see their money as spending money, like go shopping, go out to dinner, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So no matter where you are in your journey and you're perceived where you are, I've heard that there's lots of people who have lots of money who think they have none.
Yeah,
You know,
there's
that their perception is like you gave that example of the people who
it's
like,
all
wait a minute.
reality. Yeah. The guy with a
Yeah.
million is looking at the guy with 10 and in an admiration, and the same, the guy with 10 is looking at the guy with 100.
So what would you say to people who are at the beginning of the journey? Like what would, you know, because I know you deal with people with, you know, many of your clients are the super, super wealthy, but what would you say to people who are feeling like behind or they're just starting out?
So I think it's about getting the basic fundamentals right and also the level of education and having a healthy relationship with money. If you're starting out, maybe depending on your age, if you're just got a job and you're, you know, 22, 23, or maybe you're in the 30s and you've just finished paying off student loans and debts and now you're or maybe you still have debts. So it's just looking at, you know, making that small progress. And that's the first kind of thing, like, you know, not to get too focused on the outcome at that stage. You want to set some goals and set some basic fundamentals of what's the salary, what are we spending the money on, how much can we put away. But it's also looking at kind of a 6 month and 12 month target and saying, let's just try and reach that point where we can then celebrate. And it's important to have in incremental occasions where you can celebrate and enjoy what you're doing, but also pat yourself on the back. Because if you're just going, okay, right, we're starting out and I've got to get to $5 million, it's a long haul slog that's probably can be disappointing along the way. So it's in some very short term attainable goals, but and being sensible with, you know, okay, we earn this much, let's save 20, 30%. Generally, as a good amount to save is your age as a percentage of your income. As
Wait,
a,
so what's that? Okay.
so you should be saving
Oh.
30% of your wage.
Perfect, because I'm 30, is what you're
Yeah.
saying.
Yeah.
Okay, your age is a percent of income. That's interesting. That's the first time I've heard
Yeah.
that. Okay.
The older that you get, the more that you
That
should be saving.
number gets higher.
Yeah. Which makes sense because you're
It
closer to
totally
work.
does. Yeah.
But also for kids, one thing that I think is really important, not to make you feel bad about this, Mary, if they're already past that,
No, I know I screwed this up. It's okay. Go ahead. I'm going to fix it in their
but
20s.
even if they get pocket money or they're doing they're working whatever they're doing to generate income, that let's say for example they're going to a friend's birthday party or they need
Yeah.
something, whatever, let's say that it's $100 and they need to go and buy something, I would be saying to them, okay, you need to earn $300 to be able to buy the $100 gift. You know, a third's probably going in taxes, a third you need to save, and a third is the gift. So it's not about just going earning $100 to buy the $100 gift. Oh, Dad, I need to go out this weekend. I want some money for some friends. It's going to cost $100. Okay, go mow the lawns and wash the car and do these things, and I'll give you 100. What that's teaching him or her is that the money goes straight from earning into buying something, and that's not reality.
I would like to rewind the clock. Probably on my own upbringing too, right? Like this stuff carries over. And in a world where things are easy and accessible and everybody has stuff, like raising kids is not doing that is in a way goes against the grain,
Yeah.
because everybody has, it doesn't matter what it is, someone has the better thing. Or whatever. So kids are living in that world, and then the immediate gratification world of, what do you mean? When we grew up, we had to like wait till Thursday night to watch our favorite TV show. Like it's literally on demand. Like everything is on demand. So that's a great practice. Somebody that I know who runs a large real estate company. So he's done quite well, but he started with nothing. He's a great. He actually wrote a book. It's a book called Something on Purpose. Anyway, he's had three daughters and he's thinking, what do I do for my kids? Because one of the things that may helped him be successful was coming from nothing and having to earn it. It goes back to your first generation. And last time I talked to him about it, he was asking a bunch of entrepreneurs the question, what do you do with your kids? And genuinely wondering, because if you've got the drive to build the wealth, that doesn't mean that you hand it down. Like what, you're not giving them the conditions where they have to figure that out. So he was saying at the time that he's not going to pay for their education, that that's something that they have to do, which I think is, to know this stuff. And I wish I had some of this insight. Simon's 20, Molly's 18, that I had it back then. I was more in survivor mode of the paying for the diapers and juggling the jobs and all that stuff. But to be in that place and have that insight and be able to kind of put your kids in the situation where they know their accountability and what it takes.
And it's
Yeah.
difficult because often, I hear it all the time. I want to treat the kids to things because I never had it. But
Yeah.
the hardship is what drives you. The hardship, you look at all the successful people that have come from generally from fear,
Yeah.
not having something, not having parents, not having an upbringing, really struggling through life, which is then given that pure grit to
Yeah.
succeed. Because there's challenges along the way and they succeed. And then by gifting the kids and giving the money, you're taking all that away from them. That inner grit. And it was interesting listening to a little thing the other day on Ben Affleck, and they
Oh
were
yeah.
talking about the kids, because I think he's got two or three kids, and he was saying, Dad, I want to have this. And he was saying, no, you're not having it. He said, well, we've got the money. He said, no, that's my money, it's not your money.
You're right.
You need to go and build your own wealth. I've done mine. I've built mine. If you anything you want in life, you go and get it yourself.
Totally.
And that's it is tough. And I've got two small kids, and it's tough. And we didn't have much growing up. And it would be easy to just go, I never got a chance to play with. I got probably one toy growing up, and being able to just go and pay $50 and everything to have lots of different toys. Dad, I want this car. No, I want a different color.
I know.
But it's no, you don't need it.
You need to have a pretty strong constitution around that stuff because in my observation, so just in we've already determined that I could have done other things. That in the moment of the kid who's sad about the friends and everything, like even like the phone, like you don't need a cell phone, you're 12 or whatever. Like there's a period of time that you push and then they sort of wear you down and the world sort of wears you down. And there is this thing like you have to be okay with inflicting your kids with discomfort. You have to be okay with that and be like, nope, I could help you, but I'm gonna throw you in the deep end and you're gonna do. Like, you have to have a really strong constitution around you're in the deep end figuring it out on your own. I don't know that I have that, and I don't know that my husband does either. Like, and it'll be different for different things for us. I can be the tough one, and I think a lot of times I am, but I have a son in university, and like he needs money. I'm like, oh, as if I'm not going to help my kid in university. He needs groceries. Now, never mind that he
It
probably
is really.
spent all the money on beer or whatever the week before. It's just not. It's a tough thing to do, and I wish I had
But
done that
our
better.
job is to, and it's right, because I, as much as I say these things, I, crumble sometimes and give in. But our job is to get them ready for the real world, and giving in, like I don't think my role as a father is to be a father, not to be a friend.
I agree completely.
And
It's the yep.
I'm hopefully going to be friends with them when they're 18 and 20, and we can hang out and have fun. But it's to get them to try and get them ready for the real world, which is
Yeah.
tough. Is it, I'm not saying this like it is really difficult. But I think to myself sometimes, like, don't give in. Don't give in when they fall over and you want to, and they're crying, pick me up. And it's so easy
Yeah.
to pick them up and put them and pat them on the back. But no, you get up on you get up yourself.
Totally. It's hard. I agree with you completely. Like, I think I've done some of it well with the let the kids figure it out. If they flunk a class, they flunk a class. They got it. Like, it's not my job to be like, all over them about their tests and their schedule and all that stuff. But it's like my mom always says, you're only as happy as your least happy child. So the discomfort you're watching them sit in, you're sitting in too. Like it's anyway. That's why you need the values. You need the values. You need like the backbone to be so strong. And in order to have that, you need clarity of vision and what you're supposed to do. Because if you're just living in the moment, then you're just gonna be like, well, this feels better for now. We'll figure out the rest later. So that's why it's so interesting to me, this entire discussion, because it goes back to values, drivers, baggage you have, like sorting all that stuff out. At a time when you can make a difference, right? Like not when it's too late, not after you've raised your kids. Like, so anyway, it's and then yet we say this and people want to avoid talking about it at all costs. So it's like, how do you get people to pay attention?
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think there's a lot of good advisors out there, and it's definitely worth reaching out to one that's local to you, or to one that's been referred by a friend, and that the good people will make a massive difference, not just on the finances, but also on your happiness, your relationship with money, and hopefully your life.
That's fascinating. I think it would be helpful for you to tell people, how do you know? Because like again, in the work that I've done with all of these different organizations, I've looked at the category a bit and I think, and you tell me if I'm wrong, but the 80-20 rule applies that 20% are going to be great and do exactly what you do, dig into the life, dig into the plan, all of that. And the 80% are what you would call asset collectors that are just like, give me your investable money and I will take care of it and then I'll make money off of it or whatever, right? So how does somebody know they've got a good one?
It obviously is a feeling, you've got to be able to have that relationship where you feel comfortable opening up. I mean, from speaking with people, it's the underlying factor comes around trust. So you've got to have that. That's a feeling thing. You can't say you have to trust that person. So the first thing is there a connection? Do you feel you can open up with them? Do you trust them? And then, if you're starting out and you're not sure, speak to a couple of people. You don't just have to, it doesn't have to be the first person that you meet. You can go on and meet with, two, three, get some recommendations from friends. If a friend says, look, we've worked with a guy for, 7 years, he's great and he's made this impact on us. He turns up, he does what he says he's going to do. You might meet with them and you get along great, but you might meet with them and you don't connect. I mean, point in working with that person, if you don't feel you can open up, even though they're great, you don't feel you can open up with them. So meet with two, three people, and you don't need to rush the process. If someone's pushing you as well to sign with them, that's probably not a great start, because if you get the right person, they'll realize it's a relationship, it's not a transaction. This is a This potentially is a long-term journey of 10, 15, 20, 30 years. So if you meet the right advisor, they should be able to give you the patience, the time that you need, the information that you need to make a decision. But yeah, that's what I would probably say.
So I love that you honed in on feeling, as a brand strategist and working with, three organizations at the same time that functionally do something very similar. It's like, it's too simple to say it's like Coke and Pepsi, but in a way, if you looked at a list of services on their what independent websites, you would see a lot of the same things. So functionally, what we do is the same. But to me, I talk like I always think about organizations. There's the head of the brand and the heart of the brand. And the head of the brand is the like features and benefits and credentials. And we've got the right people with the right level of competence. But the heart is the soul, it's the purpose, it's the mission, it's the energy. And to me, that's the magic that differentiates, however many businesses there are in a category. It's that culture, it's the values, it's the feeling, it's the way of engaging. And that doesn't mean that one is better than another. It's just a different fit. And so, what's interesting in most categories that they focus on the what we are the best at. We can get you X better what fuel mileage or returns or whatever it is, and they lean on that when really it's the intangible stuff that stands apart. And that's where the part that you have to go, no matter what advice you give somebody, they have to see and meet someone and see how it feels and see if that's a match.
And it ultimately it's the way that we make the person feel, because investments will do whatever they will do. Some will go up, some will go down, and it's the way that it's a relationship, and it's the way that we make the client feel, or the way that the advisor makes the client feel.
Well, this
It's
has been fun.
personal thing.
So thanks for this conversation. I think it's just such, I mean, probably talk about each of these things in their very own podcast because there's so much to it. The
And if
psychology.
anybody has any questions, just feel free to write it in the comments, and we'll reply. But The Psychology of Money is a great book to start with, for anybody that wants to delve into this a little bit deeper.
Yes, please. And if you like this podcast, please subscribe and share it with your friends.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
everybody. Have a good one.
Catch you next week. See you all. Bye-bye.
And that's all for this episode of Meaningful Mischief. If you found value in today's conversation, you can subscribe wherever you podcast. And hey, spread the mischief yourself. You'll find all the links in the show notes. You can visit us at meaningfulmischief.com and follow us on Instagram at meaningfulmischief. Until next time, keep making meaning and have fun while doing it. This is Meaningful Mischief, signing off.